Well, that's, you know, the seminar date has been carefully chosen.
Is that focused there?
Is that not well focused? It says, as you see, that the date has carefully chosen, so if you have some doubts, and don't take that too seriously or too personally. So thank you for the invitation and for the arrangement. And of course, the topics are a little bit speculative. And according to Francis Hawson's standard, this certainly will fit in two stars. At least each line, you will have a one star with that. I mean, a star means that you haven't observed something yet, so that's virtual. I mean, the virtual, that's double virtual. But it's, I guarantee you it's fun. It's fun to play with this. Okay, so first of all, I will give you a very brief introduction, which actually is not really necessary for the so-called low string scale, low quantum gravity scenario these days, and a lot of studies in the literature already. And then I go to the main part of the theoretical work. It's about the open string amplitude construction. So we try to construct the open string scattering amplitudes to represent the standard model particle scattering so that we can apply this formalism into some phenomenological studies. And then with these amplitudes, we briefly studied the low energy constraints on this amplitude, essentially on the new physics scale. And then we move on to the main body of this discussion to apply this formalism into the cosmic neutrino scattering and the cosmic neutrino detectors to see the possible observation for the signal. Finally, I summarize. And this is a work. The main part actually is done in collaboration with two students, and Josh Fries, actually he was a very bright undergraduate student. Now and he graduated, he moved to Princeton to do real string after working on this string physics a little bit. I don't know whether I have done some good service, so which way it did. Anyway, he moved there, and Dan Hooper is a Francis student, and he's moving to Oxford for his postdoc. And some further studies along this line, in particular on the collider consequences, are still ongoing. One of the students are working with me to push it forward. Well, as I said, it doesn't need much motivation anymore because the scenarios seem to be very interesting, and a lot of theoretical efforts and phenomenological efforts have gone into this. So now the question is, what if the quantum gravity scale or the string scale is as low as TeV? Then the theoretical motivation was to remove the so-called hierarchy problem. And this scenario simply provides some possible understanding of this rather large Planck scale. So that was the theoretical motivation. What is most interesting to me is about the rather rich phenomenology near the TeV scale. Okay, you will be able to probably probe some actual dimensions by the Kluge-Klein excitations, and maybe you reach the string scale, then you produce some stringy states, and maybe you are lucky to go even above the quantum gravity scale, you may produce black holes. And then, of course, those physics may have some low energy effects, and the absence of the observation puts some constraints on this scenario. It's also interesting to explore. And more interesting to us at this conference, this workshop, probably some astroparticle physics consequences, such as some effect for very low mass states in supernova and neutron stars. And in particular, what we are going to discuss today is the high energy cosmic ray signals for those possible new physics states. And also, it has a lot of very rich, interesting applications in cosmology, such as new dark matter candidates, maybe new the stereo neutrinos in the actual dimensions, and maybe additional possible handle for cosmological constant problem. So it's a very rich topics along this line. So it's an interesting part. But of course, it's not easy to really have a very consistent theory or model. Lots of challenges to really make the model work, such as how you stabilize the actual dimensions, why the actual dimension is such or this big or this small. And the gauge unification is very different because of the existence of actual dimensions, and the theory fundamentally is not renormalizable. The coupling constant is dimensionful. And I think phenomenologically, more serious problem is about the flavor sector and how to keep nucleons stable and how to reproduce a standard model like flavor physics. It's a lot of interesting but challenging topics there. So this is not I want to discuss. So I just simply ignore the challenges. Let's look into the possible consequences, interesting phenomenology. So that's what we want to talk about. Okay, so thinking about phenomenology, let's refresh our memory about the physical scales here. There's essentially only one dimensionful scale. We call that a string scale. I use it M sub S. In the string theory, it's proportional to the tension T. And in the old string theory, it's inversely proportional to this parameter alpha prime, which is usually called the Ricci slope. Okay. In the infinitely large Ricci slope, in the zero Ricci slope, and alpha prime is zero, that means infinite tension, a very high string scale. So in that limit, there's essentially no stringing effects, and everything supposed to reduce back to standard model physics, okay, in the zero Ricci slope limit. And then the other scale actually is more concrete. That is the quantum gravity scale. We know that from the Newton constant. So the reduced Planck scale in the four-dimensional theory is just our regular Planck scale given by this relationship here. Now, with the existence of extra dimensions, and when you integrate over the whole space-time, then you find if this M sub d is a more fundamental d-dimensional Planck scale, and picks up additional volume factor here. And then if we, normally, this string scale has some relation with the quantum gravity scale in any given theory. Okay? It's the model dependent. And typically, it's some kind of quantum gravity scale times some some string coupling to a certain power. And this is this depends on the model, depends on compactification and many other issues. Typically, this is some kind of a relation here. Basically, this quantum gravity scale is a factor of a few times the string scale, not very far away normally. And furthermore, in the traditional string theory, if we simply use this the string scale with in connection with this quantum gravity scale, it is related to the coupling constant in linearity. So it is essentially the Planck scale times the string coupling. So it is same order magnitude. The string scale will be same order magnitude as a Planck scale, maybe up to order for 1 or order for 0.1 coupling. So this is a very high string scale. As I said, usually you won't expect to see much low energy consequences from this traditional quantum string theory. However, if you believe some existence of possible large extra dimension, and if you equate these two relations, assuming that this large extra dimension is compactified to reproduce the four-dimensional quantum gravity scale we have been thinking of, then that relation reduced to the string scale to be equal to this Planck scale normalized by the large volume of the extra dimensions. And so if the large volume is quite large or sizable, then because of this compensation, and this string scale can be reduced down as low as a TeV. So that's possible. So that's why people are thinking the possibility to explore the TeV scale quantum gravity and TeV scale string theory. So in principle, it's not difficult to do. Of course, it depends on your string structure and deep brain picture and so on. So that's something we don't have to get into in details. Okay, so with this possibility of a low string scale in mind, let's look at low energy consequences in the phenomenology we expect. I discuss this in three energy regimes. One, I talk about this very low energy, and then I move on to the very high energy above the string scale, and I discuss somewhere in between. Okay. First of all, in the very low energy region, very low, I mean the accessible experimental probe, it's much, much lower than the string scale, and maybe even much smaller than, much lower than the compactification scale. So that means the rather small actual dimensions. And this is essentially what we have been experiencing. This is effectively a four-dimensional theory, very much like the standard model, plus very weak effect from gravity. So this is just almost like the very high string theory with a very small actual dimension. So the effect is just a standard model, pretty much plus the normal gravity. That's what we're experiencing, very low. But now if the energy probe is somewhere higher, it's still much lower than the string scale, maybe the large actual dimension is opened up. So the energy scale, the energy probe is shorter in wavelength into the actual dimension, but still much lower than the string scale. In that case, we are marching into the actual dimension. So you will really directly probe the physics with the gravitational effects, because this is the additional actual dimension. So what you're observing is a lot of closed Klein reductions, at least the gravitons. Maybe whatever particle propagates into this actual dimension, you will have the closed Klein states, but at least gravitons. Gravity defines the space-time, so gravity will definitely go to the actual dimensions. So whatever comes into the actual dimension, you will have a closed Klein states. The effective theory will be standard model plus relatively light closed Klein states. Relatively light means below your accessible energy already. So this is what the scenario people have been, so typically the ADD scenario people have been exploring a lot. So this is what that category. Now the other, before I talk about the string scale, near string scale, let's think about the other extreme in trans-Planckian energies. And the energy is much larger, if energy accessible is much larger than the string scale, maybe even larger than the quantum gravity scale, again you probe the gravitational effect. And in fact, the semi-classical argument shows that the gravity effect may be the dominant feature. So then if the center mass energy is larger than the quantum gravity scale, maybe even larger than the black hole mass, then if the impact parameter for the incoming colliding particles is smaller than the size of the Schwarzschild radius, and then semi-classical argument shows the black hole may form. So this is also an interesting possibility, and people have been exploring the consequences a lot, and people were talking about the possible observation at the LHC and any other TV scale new experiments. Okay. So then that will be very...
Han, would you care to comment on the criticism by involution?
Right, so the semi-classical argument here is very crude. Basically, the argument is that once this the energy is large enough to produce the mass, and the impact parameter is smaller than radius, boom, you form a black hole. And the cross section, the strength for this formation is simply given by the geometrical cross section. And that's very, very crude argument. And Volochin listed three or four different reasonings, and this geometric cross-section is not a good approximation. But the bottom line is this issue is not settled. And his argument actually was reasonable, and he said if the energy is so high and the particle would not stay intact before they scatter, and they probably will break up to form some other forms, and this simple geometry argument is not really the good approximation. And he also argued because of the unitarity, and the black hole has so many states to decay into, and the kind of an entropy argument. For one particular pair to form black hole is inversely proportional to that. Mm-hmm. So the cross-section actually has a huge suppression rather than simple. Several arguments like that, and, but none of these is strong enough to be accepted right away, because simply the full simulation, non-perturbative gravitational scattering simulation has never been performed in GR, in the full GR non-perturbative simulation, to see how two-body problem should be rigorously solved without any perturbation theory. That has not been performed. So nobody really knows whether his argument actually is true if you perform simulation. And some people simply put some exponential suppression factor he argued in, and to see the change, see the phenomenological changes. Yeah. So it's still not settled. Many simulations, many string models actually support the kind of geometrical argument. Yeah, it's not clear which way actually is more accurate, better approximation. Yeah, it's unsolved. I think those numbers don't include the suppressions. Some other future calculations, and Tom Rizzo has some calculations. You probably did. Did you? So you probably show something that. Yeah, I don't remember. It could be suppressed by order one order magnitude or two, but it's still not a disaster to completely wipe out the observation. Yeah. The overall conclusion probably won't be changed, but you don't have a spectacular number of events, but you have some observation. The conclusion is still, the conclusion of the observation still more or less remains. Okay, so this is what we want to discuss today in detail. What is somewhere in between? And in fact, somewhere in between, that basically means that the energy probe reaches near the string scale or maybe the quantum gravity scale. There are strong arguments to show that this region may be the most interesting and most prominent places to really observe the signal. First of all, the graviton effect I discussed in the low energy case, the graviton effect actually is correspond to closed string scattering. And formally, it is a higher order in string perturbation theory. So normally, if you only count the coupling constant power, this is actually suppressed with respect to the particle scattering in the higher order. Secondly, if you reach the threshold, and you may expect to have some resonances, and this is almost like the weak interactions. If the scale is much lower than the WZ masses, and the suppression is not coming from the coupling constant, but rather coming from the big mass suppression, so you don't see the effect there. It's just due to the energy is not high enough. But if the energy is high enough, the coupling constant doesn't cost you much. Actually, it's even in favor of open string. The particle scattering, and when the resonance is very nearby. So because of these two arguments, it is reasonable to ask the question, what kind of physics you may expect some kind of resonance near the threshold region. And I think this region probably has much better chance to observe new physics than either cases. And near the low energy end, the graviton emission has a very steep rise near the threshold region. Below that, there's a very high power suppression. You'll be really lucky to even see some deviation in that region. Way above that region, it's almost too good to be true. How can you all of a sudden jump over this? Actually, many discussions, including the proton decay problems, all that, basically set a scale pretty high. It's quite a few TeV, not the quantum gravity scale, the black hole masses. Quite a few TeV. So most likely, historically, we always observe new physics gradually when we reach the threshold. I think the threshold region, of course, is difficult to do. It's very much involved. We sometimes even don't know what we are doing. But nevertheless, in that region, it's more likely to have some new physics to show up than the rather weak signal in the low energy tail or such a spectacular signal near the black hole region. So I think this is the reason, even difficult, we probably should try and to see what we can say. Well, okay, now come to the main part of the construction. We want to study the string scattering amplitude and hopefully to see the string resonance effects. There's a generic formula to write down the tree-level open string amplitude. It's essentially for 2-to-2 process, four-point function, and this is the string coupling constant with some factors here. And essentially, the three terms, that is symmetric under STU crossing. So, well, that's interesting that STU, Mandelstam variables are three, and you have three symmetric terms. That's probably consistent with the trinification.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We haven't studied this consequence for the application to trinification yet. But anyway, so let's discuss these three factors. The first factor is trivial. This is S as a function for two kinematical variables. This is essentially the Vanisiano amplitude. I said it basically, but it's basically amplitude, Vanisiano amplitude. If you want to ask why it's basic, I can discuss later. Now, this Vanisiano amplitude approaches one in the zeros Rigid slope limit, which means the low energy limit, which means that the energy scale is much larger than your center mass energy scale. And so all these Vanisiano amplitudes approach one. OK, okay? So that it reproduced, presumably reproduced the standard model amplitude. But if the energy is very high, you see this argument, S channel in particular, S channel argument to be zero or negative integers will lead you to some singularities. And those give you the resonance poles. So for these to be negative integer, you find this this S over the string scale mass squared to be integer in this region, and then you approach some resonances. But it's interesting to see the resonance mass is the string scale times the square root integer. So this is very different from the closed Klein. Closed Klein usually goes with integer. So if you find one resonance or two or few, you can probably tell whether this is a kind of a resonance from this kind of a stringy structure rather or from some kind of a closed Klein reduction in the extra dimensions. Okay, the second factor here is that the chain pattern factor, those T's here. Those T's depend on the gate assignment, gate quantum numbers. In QCD, that will be something like our SU3 matrices. Okay? So this is model dependent. And this depends on how you put your standard model particles into your string theory. And this is the model dependent part. That actually is the most difficult part. This is where the string theory hangs up, couldn't reproduce standard model anymore correctly. So we will discuss this a lot. So this is the central part. The third part is the famous Park amplitude. Okay, so Steve must be happy that this is a very interesting matching. Then these A factors are the kinematical factors coming from the spinners and gauge boson wave functions and all. And this part, in any given gate theory, in our particular standard model SU2 cross U1, even SU3, and they are completely known in the massless limit. They are completely worked out, and you just read them off from Stevens' famous physics report. So this is it. So let's discuss the details of these three. The Van de Ziano amplitude retrieval, I don't discuss about that anymore. The kinematical factor, as I just mentioned, are completely known for any gate, any given gate structure. For example, I can consider massless gate boson scattering. I can consider gate boson pair to fermion pair, and also I can consider four fermion pairs. And for mass, in the massless limit, I know everything. It's simply given by the spinner products. Okay. It's simply read this off essentially from Stevens' phase report. So the A factors are completely known for any given Hilletian structure in the massless limit. The only thing we don't know is chain pattern factor, which actually is the model dependent part. Well, Paskin and the collaborators made an effort a few years ago. They took a particular string theory, embedded QED into it. Okay. What they did is trying to identify, they eventually project this theory into into a U1 gate theory, and with these three particles as SU2 adjoint representation. So they identify the fermions and the photon as SU2 generators, so they form a closed algebra, and it's very kind of, I think it's an interesting embedding in QED, but then with this specification, they are able to calculate these gamma matrices. So the goal is to calculate the chain pattern factor of the gamma matrices, and they evaluate the gamma matrices, and typically the chain pattern factor is a quarter or half and that order of magnitude. And therefore, they can write down the final expression, such as the Ballard scattering. And then there, they have a string coupling constant and the kinematics and the Van de Ziano amplitude, and this chain pattern factor is calculated here already. So then the only identification is the string coupling is the QED coupling, which actually is kind of arbitrary, but that's the best you can do. You assume the string coupling is the gauge coupling in that case. Well, actually, it's quite an achievement to be able to reproduce the QED amplitude from some kind of a string embedding already. But they cannot go any further. If you include any more standard model particles, in particular non-abelian interactions and chiral states, and it's impossible to project out only the things you want. You always create a lot of unwanted states, in particular massless states. And that's why the string theory is unable to reproduce the variable standard model yet. It's a pretty much the same story. Somewhere you have just too much junk, so you cannot go any further. Yeah, essentially, because it's just that the gamma matrix is traces. It could be zero. due to symmetry. If there's some particular symmetry in your model, the chain pattern factor T can be zero. It's just essentially four gamma matrices, well, not gamma, four lambda matrices, typically SU2, SU3 matrices. It's ordered from 0 to 1, essentially from 0 to 1.
So they could be parameterized.
Yeah, good point. My student. See, that's what we do. We parameterize that, okay? So we don't know the string theory, but we know phenomenology. So we parameterize that one as a known parameter. But okay, instead of constructing the chain pattern factor explicitly, which has been failed for many, many years, we take this model parameter T as a known. But the criterion is to determine this amplitude to match the standard model amplitudes at low energy we know well. So that's the idea. Then, therefore, we can start from the string amplitude, identify the string amplitudes as a zero mode, standard model particle production, which is typical, everybody does that at a low energy. By construction, it leads to the correct massless standard model amplitudes at low energy, at this low energy. Without calculating this and assuming those T's are free parameters, you will see how the T's come about. So then if you go beyond this low energy region, then you start picking up the stringy states from the Veneziano amplitude. In this low energy limit, you demand this amplitude to give you a standard model amplitude. And therefore, by construction, by cancellation, you eliminate the unwanted massless states. So this is the approach. Of course, we don't have the mechanism to for the symmetry breaking, such as the mass generation, the Suzy breaking, and on, but whenever we need a Z mass, we throw in the Z mass. Whenever we need a top quark mass, we need to throw in top quark mass. We don't have anything more to say. This construction doesn't do anything for that in that regard.
So these chain pattern factors, they're somehow the projection of all these projection of standard model particle states onto all of these string states.
It's more about the standard model particles embedded into some larger gauge theory that is reduced from the Super Young Mills theory. And normally you would have a deep brain with U n equal to 4 Super Young Mills theory, but you do a lot of orbit folding to project. To break the symmetry, and eventually you break symmetry into your SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, which is not done, it's failed. And the passing company break that into U1 only to have a very small, minimal set of particles, three particles, after their breaking.
And the different ways of breaking gives you different
Yeah.
chain pattern factor?
Definitely, yeah.
And,
yeah.
And I guess when Chan and Bain did this, they were just looking at QCD.
They basically only generalized the Veneziano amplitude to include the isospin symmetry. Yeah, isospin, SU2 isospin symmetry. To the chain pattern's work was to generalize the Veneziano amplitude into a larger symmetric class to include the isospin, SU2 isospin symmetry. So therefore, they have the isospin lambdas into the game.
Did what they did. What was that? You were doing QCD studies?
Yeah, I mean, the amplitude is a product of three factors. There's the string part, which we ignored because that comes from the Vinciano-Sarney model. There's the chain pattern factors, which are basically associated with the gauge group, or whatever, however complicated that is. And then there's a kinematical factor associated with the spin and the momentum of the particles.
That's the part from the spinners and gauge boson wave functions and this kinematical part. And for any gauge, given gauge theories, and we know that part very well, that's essentially what the helicity amplitudes did for you. Chain pattern factors and the helicity amplitudes don't do anything. The gauge coupling part is factorized out, but that part is unknown. As you said, for different the orbit folding, for different commodification, that will lead to different gate theory. And so far, there's no successful one yet, a single one. And many people are working on this, and Mehran Shvetic and company, and they were trying to, and Ibanez and company, they were trying to do different things to hopefully to have a realistic standard model spectrum. But it's very, very hard. No really, no real model yet. But it might be interesting to pick up one of their models to calculate the chimpanzee factor. Yeah, so but the.
So, do I understand? So, you're going to calculate like gluon scattering and see a string resonance,
yeah.
For example.
Yeah.
So, then in the zero slope limit, your formula should reduce to the correct gluon scattering.
That's a demand. That's a demand, yeah.
So, that'll be a constraint.
Yes.
Let's move on.
That's exactly right. Let's move on to see if you agree with this approach. So, this is what we are doing, it's exactly what Scott is leading to. Now let's take a look at one typical scattering process. And this is the reason I picked this up is this is the most stringent constraint at low energy, the contact interaction. Let's pick up this standard model process. We write down the general string amplitude with these kinematic factors, and Van der Zandt resonances, and unknown chimpanzee factors. For any given theory, you can calculate. We don't pretend to know the theory. Then in low energy, and those are S1, so we can decompose this into T-channel, U-channel, and those are unknown factors. This is string amplitude in low energy, in the zero slope limit. But we know the standard model scattering amplitude for this precisely, in the massless limit. So the first term is the photon exchange. The second term is the neutral current Z exchange. So then we match these two. So there's no U term, and these two has to be equal. So they are equal to be something, T. We don't know. It could be zero, could be one. Okay. So we don't know, they must be equal. And then we identify the string amplitude as SU2 gauge coupling. This is one of the things we don't know how to justify. But that's best you can do. You assume the string amplitude is the gauge scattering amplitude. You have this identification. Thirdly, this term has to reproduce my standard model result. If I call everything here a constant C, it's really the gauge, the almost like the gamma matrices, your gauge charges, all your gauge charges, and this constant C. So this term has to be equal to this standard model constant C plus the additional one here. So once you identify this thing, you have only, basically only one parameter, P. So then what you have here is your string amplitude, this one. This string amplitude is rewritten as a standard model one, exactly a standard model one, times the Van der Zandt resonance, and times additional term. That term is proportional to the single unknown parameter, T. But I know this term goes to zero in the low energy limit, and this one goes to one. So in the low energy limit, the amplitude reproduces a standard model amplitude precisely. Therefore, we claim there's no T and U channel massless resonances, not resonance, STU massless particles. So it certainly reproduces the standard model amplitude as you want to, but only cost is we don't know T. We cannot calculate T. No one can. So those who can, that's always wrong. So that's the way we're doing it. Okay, let's take the low energy to see to keep the leading term. So the dominant the leading approximation is one, but plus the next leading term. Due to the ST symmetry, the next leading term comes in not in linear, but rather ST quadratic. And that tells you the correction onto the standard model is proportional to the cutoff, some cutoff to the fourth power rather than the second power. So the constraint is not very strong. So the typical constraint from Hera and from Tevatron, the constraints are typically a few hundred GeV in order for TeV also. Only. It's not very strong at all. So then the other lower energy constraints, such as from B physics and so on, would be even more insignificant due to the much smaller energy you put on there, the new like B mass or typical. So this probably is the strongest limit. It's only about.
The constraint has some dependence on this unknown parameter.
Yes. If you put non-zero parameter, the constraint becomes a little bit stronger, around 1 TeV. If you set this to be zero, normally you do have the T-independent piece. That's just a correction to the standard model part. So this part is always there. And changing this T parameter probably will vary this quantity somewhat. Yeah?
If you choose a strong interaction process where you have a strong coupling to both instead of the SU2 coupling.
Yeah.
But you might have the constraint on MS, maybe order of magnitude.
Yeah, well, that's a good question, but we don't think so for the moment. So look at the Tevitron, and this constraint comes from the Drill-Yan process to E plus minus. Then the tail of the Drill-Yan process deviation is extremely tight. It's very accurate in a few hundred GeV region. But for the gluon, cross-section is larger. You're absolutely right. Cross-section will be larger, but the uncertainty on the 2Js, PT distribution and 2Js environment mass, the uncertainty may be quite substantial. We haven't done that part yet, but that part I think we are moving on to that. In the future, we probably will move on to that and to make predictions and what you see at Tevitron or something. But the constraint so for the moment we think this is the strongest. Yeah, and this constraint also some other studies like during the Harrod anomaly events. In the high end, many people worked on this four-point constraint, and we read some literature. We thought the Harrod and the Tevitron are still the strongest ones, but that one would be an interesting one to explore. But we think it's due to the uncertainty, may not be as stringent. Okay, let's accept this, and let's move on to the resonances. Okay, now when the energy is close to the string scale resonance, the expansion takes a different form. It's not a low energy expansion anymore. It's actually the sum of a bunch of resonances. As I said, the energy is equal to square, the resonance locates at the energy times the string scale times the square root of that the n integer. So that's then we put these resonances back to the standard model amplitudes. We know for this E quark scattering, and this is standard model piece, we simply throw in the Z mass. My apology for that. We have no way to systematically generate the electric symmetry breaking anyway. So this is the standard model piece. And then this is the leading resonance contribution from the first string and second string and on and on. So those things you probably will hopefully predict how to search for those things at the collider energies. Okay. Then, of course, you need to calculate the total width to regularize the resonance, and it's not hard to do. We did that also. Now, the main part of the numerical studies, neutrino scattering of nucleons. So we studied this a simple process. This is actually the reason we wrote this paper first is this process actually is even simpler. In the standard model at tree level, this amplitude actually is even zero. But the neutrino quark scattering, we also did that, and some other people did neutrino quark as well, and it turned out to be somewhat smaller, largely because of the much larger gluon flux at higher energies. Okay. So this is our emphasis. We want to study neutrino gluon scattering, and following the same path, we identified the 2-to-2 process at the string amplitudes, and this part is the kinematical factor, and the resonances and unknown piece. In order to match the standard model amplitude, we set this to be zero when this when the standard amplitude approach to one. So you can see that due to the massless limit, S plus T plus U has to be zero, and therefore all these quantities again have to be equal and one parameter. And typically it's somewhere around this range. And it could be zero in principle, but we hope it is not. Now let's look at the interesting consequence. Let's look at the physics. This is a neutrino gluon scattering in the S channel, or actually in the T channel as well. You have some fermionic state that carries both neutrino and gluon quantum number. This is something similar to people in the composite model and many other models. People are talking about lepto quark and lepto gluon. So there's such a state predict in this amplitude. And the other channel actually is rather weird. I don't know exactly how to interpret the other state. In the T channel, that is a gluon, you see the neutrino coming in and gluon coming in and out, some exchange in between in the T channel. And I think the most convenient one is just assign this a vacuum quantum number. We have a vacuum quantum number to mediate these two currents. That's most convenient for me. But I don't know whether this is a good or bad or string theory would like it or not. But it could be some adjoint the particles charged under both SU2 and SU3. I'm not exactly sure what kind of excitation, what kind of states you can't really identify in a bigger string unified picture. presumably. But the easiest one is, well, it would be nice to have some vacuum quantum number exchange between the neutrino and the gluon tree level. But this channel is needed in order to keep this amplitude reproducing the standard model amplitude at low energy. Okay, now we have the full amplitude. We expand the Vanisiano amplitude for the polar resonances. And when we want to study this, the polar resonances dominate at high energies. So we sum only over the S channel to estimate the scattering cross section. Basically, we only sum over this, the left gluon as resonances. You can expand these in two ways. One is in N for the resonances. The other one is around the angular momentum decomposition. So then you see the amplitudes given by these. And then we use the dispersion relation. We can calculate the partial width. Actually, we assume this is a total width. We assume that the elastic channel is the whole story. Then this the total width is calculated by the matrix element taking the imaginary part. So that's easy to do. Now, this part is also standard. And calculate the narrow width approximation, and then fold this into the structure functions for the gluon, any partons, and sum over the resonances here. So this gives you the total neutrino nucleon cross section in this simple way. However, how many resonances you sum over? In principle, you sum over as many as you can. But we are a little bit nervous, and if you sum over too many to go to extremely too high energy, and this formalism may not still be valid, because the quantum gravity and other things may come in. But nevertheless, we give it a try. This contribution should exist there in any way, even with the existence of other quantum gravity corrections. We sum over up to 40 or 50 or so, it doesn't change the numerics very much. Due to the very high end, they're so massive, the gluon luminosity dies away very fast. And if you change this from 20 to 80 resonances sum over, numerically it only changed 10% or so. So numerically it doesn't make any difference, but conceptually we don't have a better way to justify how many resonances you need to sum over.
These people, you aren't using gravity anymore, right?
Exactly. So
if you watch yourself from string theory or quantum gravity, you could take the sum.
No, string theory is necessary, right? This is really the string amplitude. You have the string in amplitude.
No,
that's for sure.
If you have some resonance,
yeah.
That's all you really need.
No, the resonance are predicted in this formalism. Even the masses are also predicted with the definite form. This is the Vanisiano resonances,
right.
particular Vanisiano resonances. It's not totally arbitrary. As I mentioned, it's even different from a closed Klein resonance. So I think string picture is necessary. Quantum gravity picture is not needed in the whole calculation. Yeah.
Well, how are the resonances spaced, for example? And when you get to the string scale, are they just
square root of n
resonances, or are there 80 of them, or how does it work?
It's a square root of n times mass. So this the resonance is square root of n times the quantum gravity scale. So if most of the time I use s equal to 1 TeV, the other one will be square root of 2, 1.4 TeV or now. So that's how it spaces.
So I'm surprised you even need to consider as many as 80.
Yeah. Yeah, so, right.
That must be a pretty high scale.
Yeah, I agree. But when I calculated the cosmic ray events, you do run huge energy to very, very high energy anyway. So that's why we extended. But as I said, numerically, it makes a 10% difference or so, even you sum over only the first 20. Numerically, it doesn't make much difference, but I do run to a very extremely high energy. I hope to maybe even explain the ultra-high energy cosmic ray events. That was also one of the hopes. Okay.
What's the physics you're cutting off? You have to impose this cutoff because what part of your calculation becomes approximate?
And actually, if the mass is too heavy, something like 50 times the string scale, then the width we calculate gradually approaches the same order of magnitude. So basically, we're gradually seeing very, very broad things, and we don't know the perturbation theory is still valid or something. And besides, if you go to 5 times or 10 times bigger than the quantum gravity scale, then the quantum gravity scale will have some effect, such as black holes, other things. We know in that region we don't want to trust it. But this part should exist. Okay, so I think the curve I showed you here should exist. It may be modified, maybe enhanced by other effects, but these things is there. So, but I don't really necessarily say this high end is still very solid and concrete, but the high end, this part is there. So this curve tells you the qualitative, even somewhat quantitative prediction for the cross sections. The green line here is a standard model neutral current Z exchange only. You can see typically around this center mass energy here is the lab energy 10 to the 6. Center mass energy is essentially 1 TeV. Near the 1 TeV region, that's where I set up the threshold. You can see the this curve is a quark only, which is always there even from the standard model resonances and plus the string resonance. But here, the neutrino part may or may not exist in this, if T is zero, but we set T to be half or so, and you can see the gluon contribution is bigger than the quark contribution by as much as a factor of five or so. So this top red curve is what the new result. The two green curves are for the black hole production. And as Danny asked, we really didn't have much to do with the quantum gravity. We didn't include the black hole production to begin with. But the referee said, why don't you compare with the black hole production and have a qualitative picture? So the qualitative picture actually is consistent. As you see that if the energy is extremely high, then the black hole scales, like the geometrical cross-section, indeed it goes faster than the Veneziano resonances. So presumably it's consistent with the general argument if the energy becomes much higher over the threshold, then probably the geometrical cross-section takes over than the Veneziano resonances. So these two blue curves are more or less reasonable. However, the last comment to disappoint Tom, and those cross-sections is not enough to explain the ultra-high energy cosmic ray yet. So we have to find other resonances to help.
He should be happy.
But didn't he want to explain or
he wants
not?
To explain using Z-bursts, not this.
Oh, okay. Okay. So we can have the Veneziano burst. Veneziano burst? Okay. Whoever bursts.
But this is Z burst in everything, right? This is T channel, U channel, S channel.
Well, S channel dominance. We basically ignore the background, the continuum background. So we sum over the S channel. Yeah.
Here, there's an assumption that all the radii are the same, right?
As I said, it doesn't have much to do with us. It's compactified, so this amplitude is constructed on the D3 brain. The compactification happens somewhere nearby, and that's a gravitational effect. It doesn't have any direct effect with us. In principle, you should have this picture in your mind, but numerically, it has nothing to do with our amplitude. Our amplitude depends only on the string scale, not necessarily make any connection with the quantum gravity scale, unless you want to calculate the black hole production. If you do black hole, you get into the quantum gravity. But here, the purely stringy. Okay. There's another comparison for several different models in the literature. And this green is what we calculated when it's the annual amplitude. And the red curves correspond to the ADD large aggregate dimension things. You can see that some of this, if you don't do anything, this violates unitarity real quick. So and that was early papers to claim, oh yeah, great, they can see they can predict, explain everything, but it's a badly valid unitarity already. And these two, we unitarize amplitude, but still rather big. And those green ones that correspond to the single Randall syndrome resonances. But you can see once you go through threshold, the valid unitarity pretty soon again. So the Veneziano amplitudes, but by construction, respect to the unitarity. Manifestly, let's put it that way. It's not exactly right. Near the resonance is valid unitarity. We don't care near the resonance, right? Near the resonance, you need to calculate the width, as what Scott has been doing. But the near the resonance violation, we don't really care. At high energy, this the concern. And the bottom curves, to compare with some black hole productions, and that's somewhat bigger. The black hole productions are somewhat bigger than the string resonances at higher energies. But the interesting thing here, this actually is paper with Francis too. Francis liked this most, and the S cube is sensitive to this TeV region, and he can claim to probably probe this threshold region, and hopefully to see whether it's continuum standard model neutrino flux, or some enhanced cross section, or something near this region. It will be more interesting. Okay, so we even go further to calculate the realistic predictions, and we used two neutrino fluxes. For the moment, we just assume, because we don't know the neutrino fluxes well yet, so we used a cosmogenic and from the high-energy cosmic ray scattering of CMB, and it's supposed to be rather robust, and also put the other optimistic flux, Waxman-Bacall, and the Waxman-Bacall corresponds to the nearly straight lines here. It's probably the upper limit to some extent, and it has a simple scaling. But the other curves here are from the calculations for cosmogenic. So we use both classes of fluxes to calculate the further experimental predictions. But of course, some people always ask, there seem to be an additional star to come in. But actually, the measurement of the neutrino fluxes would be the one of the major goals to begin with. Once you have the detector set up, in the beginning, you measure those neutrino events, and you more or less know with certain accuracy the fluxes. So we should not, the unknown factor, for example, for the LHC luminosity should not be considered as uncertainty for our theoretical prediction. Okay, so the fluxes should be known better when you are ready to analyze the T viscoelastic new physics. Okay, that's best we can do. Then we try to simulate these two detectors. One is Auger air shower, that's the large area and a huge energy deposit. And we also calculate the ice cube detector sensitivity. And there are many studies for these detectors already for different models, but we performed a particular model for these string resonances. So this is the summary table for the events. We did Auger here and ice cube. Number of events per year for two different fluxes, Waxman-Bacall limit and cosmogenic. And of course, we put in all this acceptance, the experimental requirements and the threshold cutoff, and some kind of a simulation as much as Dan Huber can do, and try to be realistic. And then put in two different energy string scales. Now you can see this is a standard model prediction after some threshold cutoff. And then for one TeV string resonance, you would expect something like three events per year or so in Auger above 0.7 standard model background. Doesn't change too drastically for the other flux. That is because the Auger has extremely high energy cutoff, high energy threshold. So in the very high energy region, you probably remember the previous curves. In the very high energy region, these two fluxes essentially overlap. So it doesn't change too much somewhere. However, for the ice cube, as I said, ice cube is very sensitive to the threshold already in the relatively low energy region. And for using different fluxes, the predicted events can change quite a bit, something like from order of 10 to order of 0.1. For two different fluxes, which may be interesting to, this always takes two sides. One is the large uncertainty for the prediction of the events. Other one is you probably can tell which flux is more reasonable. It probably gives you some handle to measure the fluxes. Now, here is another interesting thing that for those who are familiar with Amanda and S-cube would know this. And because of the huge enhancement for the neutrino scattering cross-section of anything, then the downwards cross-section and upwards cross-section events would be very different, because the Earth may become opaque for neutrinos just due to the much larger cross-section. Normally, the standard model neutrinos can go anywhere, but at such a high energy, the cross-section due to the new enhancement is huge, and the neutrino, the Earth even become opaque for the neutrinos. And if you look at the downwards and upwards events, they don't match anymore. So then there's also indication that some enhancement, some huge scattering cross section is ongoing. So then you want to study both downwards and upwards to compare the number of events. Nevertheless, you see some possible enhancement over the standard model expectation, somewhat marginally. But the conclusion is that with a few years data taking, so you just sit there and accumulate data, if the scale is order for one TeV, maybe marginally okay for two TeV, but not very much, not much stretch beyond one TeV, then the number of events may be maybe significantly enough to compare, to claim some enhancement, claim some access.
Enhancement compared to what?
To the standard model, to the standard model neutral current process.
But again, you said you don't know what the flux really should be.
Yeah, but I hope that when you are ready to analyze the data, you have some measurements there already, and you hope to do the threshold to see whether it's kind of continuum or somewhere you have, yes, you do have the uncertainty. But if you know some low energy neutrino flux events already, then you gradually extrapolate from your standard model prediction and to see, well, some access creeps up.
You want to look at the many spectrum, right?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Oh, many spectrums. Any spectrum, and even angular, and multiplicity. I don't know how well, and Francis claimed you can do
it. Is as low as one TeV, because at two TeV there's no difference.
Two TeV is hard.
Wrong.
Yeah, we know it's at one TeV, right? We don't.
For that, to use the energy and angular distribution,
multiplicity, yeah, multiplicity,
maybe
bunch of, yeah.
Reasonable.
Sure, yeah.
So this event would be just from this resonance, right? Or little number?
Unfortunately, you don't really see the resonance structure unless you go to the collider experiments. This is not well controlled.
Because even in standard model, you have 8.4.
S cube or the O'Shea? S cube.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's factor two difference or so. If you can also this is only one particular the cutoff. You probably can play with the cutoff, a lower cutoff to allow more events in, which gives you the worst systematic. You increase the cutoff to have a increase to have a better systematic, but with worse statistics. So, yeah, you can play a lot. But this, I think, from experimental viewpoint, you can take this as a qualitative picture, and quantitative one. And you really need probably more simulation than knowing better about the fluxes to begin with. Yeah. Okay. So that's a summary. I think it is interesting to think about the near string resonance region. At low energy region, you have some quantum gravity effect, but at the closed Klein gravitons, nevertheless, weakly coupled. You may have some sensitivity, but the suppression there usually is very severe as well. It would be nice to have a black hole factory at the LHC. We'll try our luck. But I think the threshold region probably is quite an important place to study. Historically, as I mentioned, the new physics most likely shows up near the threshold. So this is the part we should consider seriously and carefully. So we followed the string amplitude construction, and the point is to reproduce the standard model amplitudes at low energies without the really pretending knowing the chain pattern factors, how to calculate the standard model particle representation in any particular model. So that is the major thing we assume, the major assumption there. The low energy constraint is not really severe because of the fourth power suppression rather than like the normal contact dimension 6 operators. Dimension 6 operators usually start from 1 over lambda squared. So this is less severe. And we apply this to the neutrino gluon scattering, and found some promising possibility to observe some events in the near future with this O'Shea and S-cube detectors. And my real goal actually started from the possible collider consequences, and we will keep exploring this the collider consequences. And there are also theoretical questions, how you trust this construction, whether you can probably understand this somewhat better, whether it gives you some more hint between the string theory and the standard model requirements. It will be interesting thing to play with it too. And well, the loop effect, which is supposed to be closed string, and gravitation effect, which should be quantified to see whether those effects may even be as big or not. Some other things, more theoretical oriented people can think about this too. That's it. Thank you.